Well, good morning. Welcome to spring. At least it feels that way anyways. It seems like we've come out of a long tunnel of a very dark winter. But now we see the lights and look forward to a spring and a glorious summer. I like to start any project that I do on a firm footing. In this case, a dissertation on compassion. A common understanding of the word, so we're all starting at the same place. For this, I turn to our dictionary. It isn't just any dictionary. It's a couple of years ago, I replaced our tattered, concise Oxford dictionary with a sight unseen Canadian Oxford dictionary as a birthday present for Kathy. I purchased online from Chapters, and it wasn't until I picked up the book at the Canada Post and had to use both hands that I realized our dictionary was no longer concise. 300,000 separate entries, although I have to confess I'm not familiar with all of them. And I've actually been putting our dictionary to a lot of use lately, looking up words that I otherwise don't use very often, xenophobia, misogynist, plutocracy, oligarchy, demagogue, nativism, surreal, alternative facts. Oops, sorry, that last one isn't a word. But I digress. The Canadian Oxford Dictionary defines compassion as pity, inclining one to help or be merciful. I wasn't sure I liked the pity part, so I turned to Wikipedia, which defines compassion as the response to the suffering of others that motivates a desire to help. I like that better, but in any event, the operative concept is the motivation to help that arises from the experience of compassion that is amply expressed in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Compassion is different from empathy, which is the, according to the Canadian Oxford Dictionary, the power of identifying oneself mentally with and so fully comprehending a person or object of contemplation. But it doesn't imply motivation or desire to help. Compassion is also a very personal emotion. Each of us is unique in what we respond to with a feeling of compassion. Compassion has been a very powerful motivator in my life, particularly since moving to the Vancouver area in 1993. I didn't always have a name for it. I just felt a wellspring of passion in my heart that energized me to take action. One instance I can recall was in the summer of 1994. An early morning beating leading to the death of a person outside a convenience store in Coquitlam. If you lived here at that time, you might recall it. A person who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. The perpetrator was a youth who, because of many in the community assumed he would get off lightly given his protection under the Young Offenders Act, was the subject of intense community outrage, including a public forum calling for retribution. Indeed, I saw the tragedy of the victim's death, but I also sensed there was another tragedy here too. A youth under 19 hanging out in front of a convenience store in the wee hours of the morning. Why was he there and not at home with his family? What was the source of his anger? And that incident led me to a multi-year initiative that Kathy and I called Tri-Cities Together Against Violence, which was a month-long series of events and forums focusing on proactive approaches to violence prevention. And a few years later, a program of restorative justice for young offenders that continues to thrive today. I think, however, that for me, the most powerful driver for action is homelessness. I find it profoundly sad that a person would not only live without secure and adequate shelter, but also without connection to and the support of family and friends, invisible to the rest of us, essentially without home. For me, action in this case means using the talents I've been given. While others minister, I like to organize. I have been chairing the Tri-City Homeless and Housing Task Group, as Joan mentioned, since late 2006, and have also been involved in homelessness planning at the regional level. Seeing a result is particularly energizing, and I am proud that Coquitlam now has a permanent shelter and transitional housing facility. But does compassion always lead us in the right direction? Sometimes it unearths ethical questions that need to be resolved. Following are two situations in which the immediate response to a feeling of compassion might not be the best one. And I don't have the correct answer for you. you will need to make up your own mind. How do you respond to a homeless person panhandling on the street? Do you ignore them walking by without making eye contact? Do you acknowledge them and give them some change? And I personally struggle with this. Outreach workers and other persons that work with homeless people will tell you not to give cash. Often the money will be used to purchase drugs, and in that way will be an enabler. And this isn't a judgment on drug use, it's just that when drug use is controlling a life, regaining control of that life is not going to happen on the street. So if you do want to respond, what are the alternatives? Perhaps provide a coffee, some food, some clothing. Perhaps you could make a phone call on their behalf. I know that one of the things that they need from me is human contact, a recognition of their humanity. But rushing by, it doesn't feel as though there is enough time to strike up a conversation. And so offering change for me, at least, lets them know that I'm aware of them. And sometimes I think if a drug will bring them a bit of peace and respite from their lives, why not? The current opioid overdose crisis accepted, of course. But what they really need is to get indoors, find community, discover they have alternatives, and giving them cash will not get them there. How do you respond? The second situation is one that is particularly close to myself as a parent and a grandparent. It was the subject of an article in the June 2016 edition of Harper's Magazine titled Hashtag Prescription, The Hidden Cost of Crowdsourcing a Cure by Helen Uwang. And I must acknowledge here that much of the wording is taken directly from that article. The article begins, on a cold Thursday evening in March 2014, a New Jersey trial attorney named Bill Burns browsed on his phone while waiting for the bill at a sushi restaurant near his home. He scrolled to a Facebook post by his sister-in-law, Emmy Hardy. Please help us save our son, the note began. Share this post if you believe a child's life is more important than money. What followed was brief and heartbreaking. The situation is this. Our son, Josh Hardy, who recently had a bone marrow transplant, has developed the adenovirus. This is a deadly virus for people who have weak immune systems. There is a drug called Rincitifor that has been proven to treat the adenovirus effectively. Our doctor at St. Jude told us they ran the study for the drug company and he knows it will work. However, the drug company has refused to release the drug for compassionate care because they're trying to take it to market. Basically, they're not going to save a child's life for money. Contrary to that initial post, the drug that had not yet been approved, safe or effective, and think here thalidomide, and could be procured only through a special FDA. This American article is the Federal Drug Administration. Can only be procured through a special FDA protocol that allows doctors to prescribe experimental drugs. The post and subsequent Twitter offerings went viral. Only 4 days after the mother's initial public plea, the Facebook page had been viewed more than 1 million times. And strangers had volunteered tens of thousands of dollars to try to buy the drug from the manufacturer, Chimerix. One Facebook photo showed Josh with a puppy, his brown hair streaked blonde from the sun. Another showed him grinning in a Washington Nationals jersey. Chimerix yielded to public pressure, released several doses of the drug, and 2 weeks later, the levels of adenovirus in the boy's blood were nearly undetectable. It had worked. Good story so far. However, Arthur Kaplan, the founder and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University, was not among those applauding. Prior to the release of Doug, he had published an op-ed piece arguing that social media and compassionate use were a dangerous combination. The campaign had framed the fight as a dispute between Big Pharma and an ailing seven-year-old. But Kaplan insisted that the ethical stakes were more complicated than that. A full moral reckoning, he said, demanded consideration of the needs of a hidden third party, not just Josh and Chimerix, but the other persons who now, or in the future, might also benefit from Rincitifor. Kaplan suggested that giving Josh a drug through the compassionate use protocol might endanger its approval by the FDA. In the worst case, Josh would die after taking the drug, and that outcome would be held against the drug and the company until they can show the drug did not kill him. In the meantime, other patients would find their access to the drug severely restricted. What's more, an online campaign powered by photographs of a sick little boy raised hard questions about fairness. Those who are not very cute get less attention in their pursuit of unproven drugs, Kaplan wrote. If Josh had parents who did not understand how to use social media, he would already be out of luck. And this wasn't about the public versus big pharma. Chimerix is a small company. They had a single product, this particular drug. And by the end of 2012, more than 400 people had received the drug through compassionate use. Compassionate use programs create, create significant constraints for small companies, not only financial, but also recruiting sufficient subjects for randomized controlled trials necessary for approval. If the company went under, there'd be no Brisinivore for anyone. In 2013, as part of an effort to bring the drug to market, Chimerix decided to end its compassionate use program. During the next year, they received more than 300 requests to use the drug, including from politically connected foreign leaders and from the CEO's close personal friends. And until Josh Hardy, Chimerix had refused each of them. How could they give the drug to one but not the others? How could they choose? And if the concern that a poor outcome in a single patient might taint an otherwise successful drug did not come to pass, something like the opposite may well have occurred. Josh Hardy's high-profile success with Brisinivore created expectations and demand for a drug that might in the end turn out to be ineffective or even harmful. And in fact, in two previous trials, it has failed to live up to expectations. The common thread is the human tendency to give disproportionate weight to concrete individual cases at the expense of the abstract many. I expect you can think of other situations where this might apply as well. And compassion can be selective too, as pointed out in an op-ed piece in last Saturday's Globe and Mail, written by a Mexican academic entitled "Canada is Suffering from a Case of Selective Compassion." She cites Canada's reputation as a compassionate, tolerant, inclusive country, particularly in how we respond to refugees from war-torn countries overseas. Yet we are seemingly insensitive to the suffering in a country with which we share this continent, Mexico. She points to Mexico's fitful efforts at democratization, its human rights crisis, and U.S.-sponsored war against drugs that has produced more than 150,000 deaths and more than 28,000 disappearances in the past decade. And yet, we remain silent when our neighbor directly to the south deems Mexican citizens to be rapists and criminals rather than victims. And now we seem ready to abandon them when NAFTA is potentially renegotiated as a bilateral agreement. To close, I would like to return briefly to the nature of compassion. I think that compassion is the Bible's still small voice that speaks to us and points us in a specific direction. I believe this is expressed by Viktor Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. This is what he says. Ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To life, he can only respond by being responsible. And he goes on to say, our question must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and in right contact. Life ultimately means taking the responsibility to find the right answer to its problems and to fulfill the task which it constantly sets for each individual. Where does compassion lead you?